The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 19. Our Many Enemies. Feferi. As the crowd dispersed, Feferi clung to Aridin like a vice, dragging him none too gently into the boat.
If you hadn't me, for fuck's sake!
Shut up and drive, she demanded, tossing him towards the helm. He scrambled against the steering column, wings splayed to keep him from crashing into it headlong. Normally she'd be quick to offer an apology. Right now, her fury was ice water in her veins, making everything a methodical series of steps. Apologies for her show of strength? Not on the list.
Seriously, what gives? Where are we going?
His voice came out in an indignant near squawk, but just as she'd asked, he was behind the wheel, turning the key with force.
To Karkatz, fast!
Before one of those witnesses calls the cops.
Or where's the hunter?
She snapped at him, already moving. The houseboat's three starboard cleats each had a rope securing their home to the dock. She hopped onto the dock, making quick work of untying them, tossing their ropes in the boat. By the time she'd untied the third and final rope, the engine was hot, and returning to the helm gave her a view of Eridan's hand clutched around the throttle.
Are you sure this is a good idea?
Drive! She urged, voice guttural with power. She could hear sirens in the distance, already fast approaching. They didn't have time to waste dithering.
You know, Rush is going to tell us fleeing the scene makes us look worse,
was all the warning he gave before slamming the throttle, setting the boat shooting away from the dock, and Feferi staggering at the sudden shift beneath her feet.
Well, maybe you should have thought of what Terezi might think before you decided to start a clubbing turf war!
She regained her footing, rushing to the starboard railing and leaning over, eyes on the shore. A lone figure stood where the docks met the shore, watching their boat speed away. Feferi tucked herself out of their sightline.
What the hell are you thinking, anyway? Don't you know how badly your mistakes hurt the community?
She couldn't keep the harshness from her voice, even as she turned to glare at him and caught an eyeful of the bruises beginning to mar his throat. The boat was moving at speed, enough for the winds to grab his scarf and pull it away from his throat, enough to buffet them both with hard bullets of rainfall. All she could think about was the predatory gleam in Aridan's eyes, as he'd puffed up his chest and other alts followed suit, sharp teeth bared and claws or talons drawn, the humans on the other side a dangerous mixture of angry and scared, all the goodwill she'd been building, all the positive community outreach, it had been torn apart in an instant.
If I hadn't scared them into dispersing, there would have been a full-blown brawl. And when the hunter showed up, that old man would point at you as the instigator.
She'd seen the old man with his bloody mouth. She'd spotted the blood painting Eridan's knuckles. All her attempts to change his attitude had been forgotten.
You don't get to complain about how this will affect the community, Feff. You weren't there. All I did was give a little extra to some skinny troll kid. And next thing I know, there's a skin monkey in my face calling me a monster and insinuating I up and ate that nice human girl who usually serves him.
There was venom in his voice as he spoke, throwing human girl in her face like an insult.
What the hell does skin monkey even mean? Human? You know you have skin, right? Vampires too? Where are you picking this stuff up?
Feferi blurted out. She clung on to her bafflement, pouring it out, while her frustration and indignation were still brewing, hoping to throw his tirade off course. As he heard her question, he was suddenly and pointedly not looking at her, staring straight ahead as he fought the wind, brow furrowed over rain-flecked glasses as he navigated through the storm. A twinge of something passed over his expression. Feferi's eyes narrowed. Now she actually wanted to know.
Eridan, who have you been talking to? Is Equius teaching you slurs again?
Eridan abruptly looked as baffled as she felt.
Equius? No. Wait, what do you mean again? Tetrapod's not a slur, it's a scientific definition.
Eridan!
Jesus, fine! Some people have thrown it around the midnight market. It's just a phrase. Don't need to think about it so hard. The Midnight Market. The place Solix told you to stay the hell away from.
Now she was plain flummoxed.
Isn't that full of drug dealers and creepers?
He stiffened, jaw clenching.
Actually, Sol's the one who brought me there. Set me up with a reputable source. Hogus products are all consensual donations. Hospital deaths. They go from flatline to morgue in minutes, and they're prepped for market by nightfall.
Well, that was a relief, she supposed.
As long as you aren't eating kidnapping victims, I guess.
Sighing, she slid to the floor, letting the rain pelt her. The awning wasn't doing shit to keep the wind from directly targeting her, but she was already soaked. Besides, if she went inside now, she couldn't keep yelling at him.
Is Helga the one calling people slurs? How do you know she's not lying to you about where she gets her meat?
She needled him, trying to get to the source of his behavior, trying to understand why he would suddenly act this way after he'd been doing so well. He shook his head, stained scarf flapping in the wind. His hands were steady, one on the wheel, the other on the throttle.
I heard it from Ramos, a vamp who was also buying. He's picking up a 2-litre. And that's how young I was, I don't know how, but he figured I wasn't a harpy, even before I approached the booth. That it was sad that a kid like me had to feel ashamed of what I was. I had to hide my needs. Said humans ought to remember that they're not different from monkeys. They just don't have enough fur to notice the resemblance. All skin.
He rolled his wrist in a leading gesture.
That's fucking stupid,
she scoffed, shaking her head.
Oh, come on, it's not really about how clever the turn of phrase is. Feff, humans treat us like shit if we scare them too much. If you don't fit in their neat little box. That old guy thought you were human, so he was fine with whatever you would give him. I can't hide what I am. If I don't bow and scrape the dirt of a monster, and they don't even know I eat human meat. Imagine what they'd do if they knew what I really was.
She jolted to standing. He jerked the wheel, a smaller vessel blowing past them in a rush of wake. He laid on the horn in response. She shouted at him, ignoring the boat shifting under her feet.
You're acting like I'm lucky. Just because I look human, you think I want this? That I want to be trapped in this body?
It doesn't matter what you want. It only matters what they see.
There's us, and there's them. And you look like them, and that's you live in this dumb little bubble. We don't see what I see. We can ignore their hate. Charm them with a smile.
Charm them?
I'm just being nice to them. Maybe they wouldn't think so poorly of you if you didn't scowl all the time, or insult them, or threaten to eat them.
I haven't threatened to eat anyone in years. I've done everything you asked me to. I'll catch you fish for the soup kitchen. I'll pay for the stoves. I got us a home, Beth, so we didn't have to rely on human handouts or force Carl to scrape something up for our sake.
I pretend to be a harpy for you, to make people like him feel safe. I cooked for them. I served them, but nothing I do is enough for them or you. One little scuffle because I defend myself, and 3 whole years of holding you up doesn't mean anything.
Feferi staggered.
I didn't say that at all. You're making up these chains of thoughts, running off on some crazy theory just to make you think that I hate you. Why, Eridan? Why do you want me to hate you?
Shut up! Eridan yelled.
You're never this cruel. Even when we were fucking terrorists, Eridan, why are you acting like this?
I said shut up! Eridan cried, his voice shredding and shrieking, echoing over her senses with siren power. It thrummed across the river water and made Feferi's bones chatter. The power didn't work on her. But she felt it nonetheless. It was a power designed to overtake the chemical and electric processes that governed the mind of a human, not whatever folds, creases, and matter of chaos and selkie composed the core of Feferi. She was not a human.
Eridan,
he didn't look at her. He knew what he just said with his powers, even if they came out involuntarily.
I know you don't always control your song. I'm not dumb enough to assume every single instinctive thing you do is supposed to reflect on what you think, but am I? Do you just think I'm a human now?
No, Fav.
I hate this body! I hate it, Eridan! At one point, it was just part of me, but I'm stuck with it. Maybe you'll have a shirt and you wear it whenever you can, but you can't just be stuck in it forever!
Hot peals of tears streaked down Feferi's cheeks.
I want to swim! I want to hunt! I want to be myself! And these!
Feferi grabbed at the tangle of hair at the sides of her head, its itch and weight a constant reminder. She smacked her fists down on her rigid, horrible legs once, twice, a third time, punctuating her next words with each violent motion.
They don't let me! You can leave whenever you want. You can fly out to sea on your huge, perfect wings and go find some beautiful siren that'll raise a whole clutch with you, but I'm stuck here! You have a choice. Don't you think I'm jealous? You think I get in the water and call out to my mom every day just because I miss her? I want to go home. I want the chance to go home. Even if I decide I want to stay here. With you.
Feferi's voice wobbled.
We've always stuck together. It used to be a shared hate, but I hoped somehow we could turn it into a shared love. To help instead of hurt. To heal in one way, if not the other.
If someone hates you, you can't love them, Eridan barked. Lightning flashed behind the storm clouds, casting his face with lucent highlights and pitch hollows. I thought I could live here with you two. But it seems like neither of us can straddle this fucking fence anymore. Maybe if I knew how much you wanted to leave me, I would have done something to try and get you to stay.
The fairy felt her jaw tighten. Even now, he was still putting words in her mouth. Anything she said would just fuel his self-justification. Keep the boat. He let go of the steering wheel and stalked to the edge of the boat, his wings unfurling like a banner. You know where the money is. Sorry I wasn't enough. He launched off with a vicious beat of his wings, sending the boat rocking. The fairy lunged for the steering wheel, pulling it on course just in time to avoid crashing into a dock. She could barely see the shape of Eridan careening through the storm, a tiny black spot against the thunderclouds. The rain fell. Her tears fell with it. Karkat. Minutes in the past, but not many. Karkat frowned. He was beginning to worry this whole endeavor was going to permanently crease his face with the expression of distaste. He watched as the hunter instructed Kanaya in front of a set of weights, the kind the gyms were filled with. Bars and bells of a cartoonish variety of colors were laid out like instruments on a surgeon's tool tray. Brodrick, is this really necessary? Mama said tiredly, watching from where she was seated a polite distance away from Karkat.
Yeah, how the fuck did you even get your hands on this many weights so fast?
Karkat asked. The hunter had disappeared up the elevator for what seemed like less than half an hour and come back with this whole ridiculous assortment.
Course it's necessary, the hunter said with obnoxious seriousness. We need to know the limits of her strength, not just for our safety, but her own.
But there was a way that the light reflected off of his glasses that made Karkat wonder if he wasn't doing this for some childish motive of determining her power level.
Now, Kanaya, the hunter turned to her. You're going to execute a deadlift. Move it up on the weights progressively until you find it difficult, at which point you're going to tell me.
Kanaya looked uneasy but nodded. She glanced over to Karkat, who cocked an eyebrow in question.
I wish to test this as well, Kanaya said. The more quickly I get a grasp of my strength, the sooner I might learn to control it.
Great, the hunter interrupted as though she'd been talking to him. Place your feet just shy shoulder-width apart. Reach down just how your arms fall naturally.
Karkat watched as Kanaya stepped up to a bar loaded with 160 pounds and did as he instructed.
This is around John's body weight by my estimate. Don't hunch your back, keep it straight. Squeeze your core muscles.
He pressed his finger just under her ribcage, slightly off to the side,
like you're trying to push this off of you.
With a barrage of prodding and correcting, the hunter eventually got Kanaya into a form he was satisfied with. Kanaya looked like all the muscles in her body were confused with what they were doing.
You mess up the form, and you'll hurt yourself,
the hunter said. He clearly had some kind of experience with this.
Well, Kanaya said, strained, that would be quite catastrophic for me to hurt myself. If it's a truly dramatic injury, it might last for 5 whole seconds.
The hunter nodded thoughtfully. Karkat snorted a laugh at her sarcasm.
Now just stand up straight.
He gestured for her to stand up. She did, easily.
Okay. You can drop it.
She did.
It hit the floor with a loud clang. This is ridiculous! Karkat stood up. I'm not going to sit here for 3 hours as you add pounds one by one. You said she shattered your sword with her fucking wrist. Just make it as heavy as you can. You probably don't even have enough weight to make her struggle.
Don't blow your load, bud.
Kanaya, how heavy did that feel?
The hunter asked.
Like picking up a throw pillow, to be candid,
Kanaya said, looking down at the heavy metal bar at her feet.
A fucking throw pillow!
Karkat threw his hands up and walked over to the lab sink to splash his face with some water. He'd been down here so long his skin was starting to dry out.
All right then, how much do you want to lift?
The hunter stepped back, spreading his arms wide, putting all the weights on offering. Karkat smacked the tap on the eyewash station for convenience's sake and let the dual streams spray over his face. The water was nauseatingly sterile.
but it beat the dry air that was being pumped through the vents. As he lifted his head, shaking the wet strands of his hair that had been caught in the crossfire, he saw Kanaya still dithering over a selection of ridiculously sized kettleballs.
"Just put all the plates you can fit on the bar!"
Karkat walked over to the weights, sliding another 45-pound plate onto the bar with an embarrassing amount of effort. Kanaya started adding them to the other side as well, moving the same weight like each one was a dinner plate. It shouldn't have made him feel emasculated, given the extreme conditions, but anyways.
"That's 945 pounds," the hunter said flatly. "That's only a touch shy of the human all-time world record."
Karkat was looking at the bar, now feeling dubious about Kanaya's chances. There were 10 massive plates squished onto either side. He pressed a heel onto one side and gave a little push. It didn't even roll on the flat floor, he sniffed.
"Maybe we should have added them on a little more," Karkat began to admit.
Kanaya stepped up to the bar, her movements so sure that they stopped him mid-sentence. She did not look concerned by the challenge before her. The hunter took a few steps back, and Karkat followed suit. And there was an aura about Kanaya that made him not want to be in a 30-foot radius of her.
"Kanaya, dear, don't strain yourself," Mama called out, looking most the part of a supportive mom at her child's sportsmate.
All she was missing was a handheld camcorder. Kanaya smiled shyly.
"I don't think I will, but I'll be careful."
She assumed the form the hunter had taught her. Karkat saw her stomach brace, her shoulders tighten, and her legs start pushing. He heard a quiet, "Fucking shit," from the hunter. As Kanaya yanked upwards, the massive weight sailed up, like it was next to nothing, and he watched Kanaya's eyes go wide. She made a yelp of surprise as her strength overtook even her own expectations. In slow motion, Karkat watched as she lost her grip on the weight and it flew up. It slammed against the ceiling and bounced. It came crashing back down with even more force than it went up with, and the whole room shook. Glassware and implements falling off benches and tables. Karkat felt it shake his legs like an earthquake, and he staggered to stay upright. He looked over to Kanaya, the weight having landed a few feet in front of her, indented into the metal floor. Kanaya took a step back from the crash site.
"My apologies."
Karkat looked over and saw that even Mama had been left stunned and wide-eyed. Beside him, the hunter pushed his glasses up on his nose. They must have been knocked down by the room shaking.
"We might be looking into classifications above dragon level now, everything considered," he said,
rubbing his chin and looking down at the wrecked floor panels. Before Karkat could make a snarky quip at him, the hunter's phone rang, sounding through the lab with an unadorned trill of tone. He reached into his pocket and answered it. Not his usual iPhone, but a plain flip that must have been for purely hunter purposes.
"Hunter?" From what Karkat could hear, the voice on the other end was in a panic, the noise quiet through the phone, but obviously peaking at speakers.
The hunter's brow furrowed. More words through the phone at a volume Karkat couldn't make out. He didn't bother trying to disguise that he was trying to listen in.
"How many?"
"I'll check it out."
He hung up.
Motherfucker.
"Was that the emergency line?"
Karkat asked as soon as the hunter dropped the phone from his ear. Anyone who knew the hunter's emergency number also knew that if they called it for anything less than a riot, they'd get their number blocked and lose the privilege of having access to the hunter for any real emergencies.
"Yes," he answered. "Got a code Silver 148. Down at your friend's soup kitchen."
Code Silver 148. Karkat recalled the various code words and call-outs the elders and hunter used to describe any upsets in the city. Silver meant a human predator and a human was involved. High priority, high likelihood of blood. But 148 meant a brawl or a feud.
At Fafari's?
Karkat's face dropped. Fafari wouldn't have made it back by now. Which meant Aridin was running the damn place alone.
"Motherfucker!"
Karkat unintentionally echoed.
"I need to leave. Keep an eye on—"
"No, fuck no!
If Alton humans are having a throwdown, do you think a hunter showing up is going to do anything but make it worse?"
Karkat immediately raised his palms. The whole city had just been made aware the hunter went AWOL alongside the human elder's daughter, and the alt side was still more than a little shaky about it. Who knew what kind of rumors had been marinating in the meantime?
"I'm going to scare the whole crowd shitless. And if that don't work, crack some fucking skulls until it does. Leave nothing behind but the waft of soiled under ruse," the hunter said.
"That's the exact problem,"
Krakat growled. It's not going to help the city's stability if the first thing you're seen doing after disappearing with Kanaya is beating down impoverished Alt at a soup kitchen.
The hunter looked over at Mama, who was looking over Kanaya by the weights. She noticed his stare and made a tight line of her mouth.
Elder Krakat may be correct in this instance, she said. We've done a lot to build up goodwill in this city. Exacerbating the damage this recent debacle just dealt to it would be unwise.
The hunter snorted and threw the flip phone at Krakat with some speed. He had to juggle to catch it.
Knock yourself out then, deputy. If we're swapping roles, then I get to sit around telling people what to do all day, eh?
Don't start crying, Krakat sneered. That won't help your image either.
Krakat, Mama said, it's still an emergency. Go.
Krakat nodded and walked off to the elevator. He could get his digs at the hunter some other time. Now it was time to clean up whatever mess Aridin had gotten himself into. As Krakat approached the dockside parking lot in Derezi's van, he was stricken by how cleared out it all looked. Only a scant few other vehicles were parked around, looking in various states of abandonment. Obviously, it was pouring rain at this point, but still, plenty of Alts luxuriated in this type of weather, himself included. He slowed to a stop, pulling into one of the empty spots closest to the docks. He hastily unbuckled, stepping out into the rain and heading towards the docks. Already something seemed off, really off. There was a tent set up near the slip where Aridin usually docked, but the pot of soup was abandoned, cups littering the dock and floating in the water. And there was a lone figure standing there, hands clasped behind their back, staring out at nothing. The houseboat was conspicuously absent. As he hustled down the dock towards the scene, the figure turns to face him, revealing a face that seemed oddly familiar. He slowed his pace to what he hoped gave off an air of authority rather than panic. The woman stepped forward to meet him, her large golden curls bouncing as she walked, an effect that seemed to be an active defiance of the pouring rain battering them as he approached. He stuck out his hands to shake, ready to speak.
Hello, I'm Krakat Gray, one of the local elders. I was with the Houston Hunter when he received a call about a disturbance at the docks. I'm here to investigate, make sure everyone is okay. Are you the one who called in?
The woman gave a tiny smile as she clasped his hand, and he fought not to flinch away at the contact. Her skin was hot, uncomfortably so, and the sensation made him want to dunk himself in icy water. In shock, he shook her hand on automatic, giving a few perfunctory pumps before bidding a hasty retreat.
I'm afraid I don't know who called your hunter. Mr. Gray, I'm simply a concerned citizen who happened to be in the area when the commotion occurred.
She stepped slightly closer than he would have preferred, and with her came a hot breeze, brushing past his skin and instantly drying him out, despite the pouring rain. Krakat stiffened, focused on pulling the rain into him, encountering the sudden sensation.
So wait, you didn't actually see anything?
He fought to keep the irritation from his voice. He didn't know what was going on here. But he hadn't been able to get in touch with Aridin or Feferi. To find everyone cleared out except someone who didn't see anything, it only made him more suspicious.
Well, I didn't say that now, did I?
The woman quirked a brow as if Krakat had failed some test, and he choked on his retort as his throat went suddenly dry.
I was in the area, as I said. It looked to me as though a bunch of human rabble were ganging up on a young avian. And one of your kinfolk came to his rescue. After that, there was shouting, and by the time I'd gotten anywhere close, all parties were running as though they'd seen something terrifying, and the Avon had escaped in his craft with a young lady.
The woman was shorter than Krakat and had not quite tilted her head to speak to him, leaving him looking at her perfectly styled hair rather than her face, with how close she seemed to be getting. But as she finished speaking, she tilted her head up, suddenly making eye contact with him. He bit back a muttered curse at the sight of her eyes. They seared into his vision, a white-hot glow that left him blinking spots from his eyes.
Are you saying the humans started it?
He managed to ask, his voice barely steady. Despite the fact that he was surrounded by water, he suddenly felt as if he was lost in the desert, starved of the dark and damp. He wanted nothing more than to jump off the docks and sink to the bottom of the harbor, propriety be damned.
That's certainly what it looked like to me. They were calling him a monster, choking the poor boy. I was walking along the shore over there.
She gestured in such a lazy motion that Krakat had not a single hope of knowing where there meant. The screaming carried across the wall, you see. They had him by the arms, by the wings. I thought they might tear the poor child apart. It was horrible. She looked away from him as she spoke, leaving him fighting to keep his composure as the effect mercifully lessened.
And you said one of my kinfolk stepped in, by which you mean what, another bridge troll?
He did his best to focus not on the heat, not on the eerie dryness that made each movement of his mouth feel as though he was cracking apart. Get a job to do. God damn it. This woman was a witness, and it was up to him to get to the truth. She seemed to be putting off some sort of passive, agonizing aura, probably a desert elemental or some sort of summer fae. He could sink to the bottom of the harbor later. For now, he needed to toughen up and take her statement. Yes, it was a bridge troll. The boy did that little party trick you're all so good at. Gave the accosters a right scare when he towered over them. By that time I was on my way over here, of course. But I'm afraid I wasn't expecting to run today. She gave another of those small smiles, and Carcat looked down at her sandal-clad feet.
So after the troll got the humans off him, what happened?
He prompted her, licking his lips in a futile attempt to moisten them. Every raindrop that hit him seemed to evaporate away quicker than he could absorb it. The sensation was excruciating. Battle lines were drawn. The shouting got worse. Someone new arrived on the scene. A red-headed young lady. And next thing I knew, half the crowd bolted. The rest didn't stay long. And it was all over by the time I got here.
Okay, thank you for that information. I will be trying to get in touch with the victim, and hopefully I can speak to those who were closer to the incident when it occurred.
Carcat wasn't sure what to think of the woman's assertions. Aridin getting jumped by random humans for no reason. He knew mob violence against alts was a risk, but it usually happened in alleyways, not around crowds. And Aridin would bristle if he knew someone had even thought the word victim in his general direction. But until he spoke to his friend in person, this was the only first-hand account he had going for him. Speaking of,
I'm so sorry, I completely forgot to ask. What may I call you?
He wasn't totally sure he was in the presence of a fae, but it never hurt to be polite. He wasn't asking for her name, just something he could expect her to respond to. Oh, that's quite all right. You may call me Serenity.
Serenity, okay. Thank you for your time. If there's nothing else you can think to add, I will be canvassing the area, seeing if I can find anyone else who witnessed what happened. This is a soup kitchen, and there's only so many places the homeless can go, especially in this weather.
He began edging away from her slightly, unable to take the impossible heat for much longer. As he moved, her lips twitched in another small smile, as if she knew exactly why he was backing away. That's all I have for you, Mr. Gray. Good luck finding your witnesses. He began to edge away faster, feeling the heat recede as he did so.
Thanks,
he turned away as he replied, beginning to walk in earnest back towards the shore. Already his mind was mapping out the area around the harbor, trying to identify where the sort of people who went to a soup kitchen would go to escape the elements. There were a few shelters in the area, he was pretty sure. The bridge troll kid might not be in one, though. If he was smart, he probably went into the water when Aridin drove off. Carcat looked over his shoulder at the empty boat slip, and at Serenity, still standing there in the rain, watching him as he left. The moisture was beginning to return to his body, but not fast enough. Decision made, he stepped off the side of the dock, sinking like a stone beneath the waves. The wonderful, refreshing coolness of the salt water filled him, and he opened his eyes to it, letting the gentle caress of water wash away the burn. Jade. Jade was painfully aware of every single sound in the room. The constant beat of the rain, occasionally punctured by a clap of thunder, provided a backdrop of patternless noise. Beck's snoring from the floor was a constant drone. Rose's soft breathing as she slept tickled the air next to Jade's ear, as they had somehow ended up so close together that Rose's mouth was mere inches behind her. Jade could feel Rose's arm flung across her midriff like a hot iron, the sensation overwhelming in its intensity. At first it had been comforting, and Jade had even managed to fall asleep for a little while. But something had awoken her from their nap, and now the heat and pressure of another living person was too much for her to handle. Slowly Jade wormed her hand under Rose's arm, gently lifting it enough for her to slide out from under it. She quietly slipped from the bed, feet hitting the floor soundlessly. Neither Rose nor Beck stirred. She reached for her phone on the nightstand, checking the time. 2:55 p.m. The glow of the screen illuminated the journal, the gold glinting in the light. Jade glanced at Rose on the bed, then back at the journal. She knew how excited her friend had been to see it opened, to get access to the truths hidden within. Part of her wanted to wait, or to wake her up,
but she was burning with curiosity. Her father had left this for her to read. Maybe she should read just a little further. She could always catch Rose up later. Her friends needed the sleep. It wouldn't be right to wake her. Besides, Rose got through the page so fast the last time she was sort of intimidating to read with. If each page was going to drop as big a bomb as the first one, maybe she needed a bit of extra time to process it before Rose's feverish enthusiasm convinced her to take their revelations to the doctor. Having convinced herself sufficiently, Jade squared her shoulders, snatching up the journal. Not wishing to disturb Rose, she crept to the desk chair, sitting down and turning on the small desk lamp for illumination. She opened the journal, glancing briefly at that first page once more. The words hadn't changed. They still told her that the man she'd known as grandfather had lied about this most basic truth. It was time to see what else he'd lied about. She turned the page.
In order to understand what dangers you may face, I must travel first into the past, into my childhood, into the secrets I was forced to bear at an age far younger than was wise. You have known me as Graham Harley. That is not my true name. I was born on a blustery night in December 1910, and christened, far more literally than you can imagine, my dear, with the name Grant Sassaker. I and my twin sister Nina were born to Colonel James Sassaker and his wife Candy. Our childhood was idyllic, cut from the same cloth as Farmer Boy, a book I can only hope I got the chance to read to you before my passing. My mother, however, made no illusions that she was an ordinary housewife. Sure, she loved to bake off like the best of them, but that was just as much an excuse for lighting fires as it was to try her hand at human creative endeavors. Candy is not the sort of name a good, upstanding gal goes by. It's the sort of name that got my mother funny looks at church, much more than the other interracial couples in our neck of the woods. Those that made the mistake of voicing their offended sense of propriety only even made that mistake the once, as my mother was no stranger to defending her good name. She just had a very different sense of goodness than you or I possess. My mother goes by many names. Some are more kind than others. Her most formal name is the one from which she took her eccentric human moniker, her illustrious Candescence. You may have heard of her by the name given to her by the Fae, the mother of mystics. Those that worship the small gods, those who mourn Hecate or Isis, they call her the God Eater. The wizards, her worshippers, usually refer to her as the Empress of Magic, for that is our understanding of how thoroughly she has conquered that essential spark of power. I've even heard the hunters call her the Founder. The truth of the matter is simple. My mother is not a human being. My mother is the goddess that sprung from the first spark created by mankind, a creature of pure power and invention. She is the force behind the global secret that is the existence of magic in all its forms. And yet, despite all her terrible and wonderful power, she decided to manifest on Earth, to take a human form, and to settle down with my father. By now you must know what wizardry entails after years under Roxanne's tutelage. Each wizard must exchange a piece of themselves, sacrifice some sacred self-control, in exchange for access to a well of unlimited power. The only thing stopping a wizard is their own limitations. I believe my father was a wizard. I have no idea what my father sacrificed, but whatever it was, it caught her eye. And thus we were born. Nina and I are demigods. I don't know if we have half-siblings. I never got the chance to ask. I've been searching, of course, but there's so much I don't know about my mother, and so much I need to know. Finding more family feels almost trivial in comparison, especially given the fact that my own sister won't speak to me anymore. I want to apologize for that, my dear Jade. You have been deprived of an aunt, of a cousin, due to my hot temper and my inability to leave well enough alone. Nina thinks I invite trouble wherever I go. She wanted a normal life, a life without magic and monsters and danger, a life without me. Though I miss her every day and I see her reflected in you, my beautiful baby girl, I would not presume to tell you where she is, or how to reach out to her. I promised her that she could live a life of normalcy. You're in far too much danger for us to risk bringing that down upon Nina's head. But when we were young scamps, learning the wonders of the world at our mother's knee, Nina did not yet know that normalcy was what she craved. We were thick as thieves, always getting into trouble as we tore through the neighborhood, pranking our fellow youths in rambunctious displays of our burgeoning power. Any transgression was easily smoothed over by our mother, leaving all the mortal children hapless in our wake. It was the sort of life that was too perfect, too peaceful. It made me crave adventure. Made me want to learn more about the world and our mother's place in it. It made me wonder what caused her to decide, those 2,000 years ago, that humans did not need, did not deserve to know the truth of the world and all its beauty. My mother never explained why she demanded the secrecy, or why she created the hunters to enforce it, or why she demanded such a high price from wizards in exchange for their knowledge. It seemed hypocritical to me, especially given our own existence. Nina and I were stronger, hardier, and more naturally magically gifted than any wizard could hope to match. This came in handy more than you might expect from two children raised in the farmlands.
After only two pages, Jade shut the journal once more. Her heart rate had skyrocketed as she'd read, her father's words leaving her gasping. She knew her father's name now, Grant Sassaker, just like the doctor's drunken confession had proclaimed. That confession had also named Grant as a demigod. It hadn't made any sort of sense, but now she couldn't pretend that it was actually nonsensical. Rather than a sloppy scrawl, the words were carefully printed on the page before her. Grant was the son of an actual goddess, a being with total control over magic. He'd said that those who worshipped small gods called his mother the God-Eater. Ergo, his mother was no small god. Candy was the other duumvirate, the one she'd given the dominion of science, when asked to guess. The other revelation, though lesser in magnitude, was still enough to shake her. She had an aunt, at the very least, and Grant had made offhand mention of a cousin as well. People who specifically did not want to know her because she was dangerous or because she invited danger. Was there even a difference? She didn't think it mattered. The result was the same. It made her feel even more alone. Jade looked at Rose. She had to remind herself that she wasn't alone, not anymore. Estranged family members out there somewhere didn't change the fact that she was with her friend, that her mentor was within reach. She needed to focus on the positives. Was being part goddess a positive? She looked down at her hands, remembering the burn of her magic as she'd overloaded the tracking spell. She'd been able to access an overwhelmingly endless amount of magic these past few days. Was all that part of her spark of divinity? Something that had been slowly growing, just waiting for the right time to burst free. Rose jolted, almost like Jade was somehow thinking too loudly. Jade scrambled to smack off the lamp and rearrange the journal on the desk, though she couldn't be sure why she was feeling so guilty about reading her father's book. After one breath of silence, followed by another, followed by Rose making a noise in her sleep that sounded conspicuously like Sigmund, and rolling over, Jade let herself unfreeze. Maybe that meant she'd read enough for today. She was, without a shadow of doubt, a demigod, and out there, somewhere, she still had family. John pulled his eyes open, smacking his lips and shifting his hips. His lower back was sore, his eyes were bleary, and his cheek was slimy. He lurched up, smearing the drool off of his cheek with his sleeve and pulling his legs off the coffee table. His heels were sore, too. How long had he been passed out for? His stomach made an audible growl of protest. Why was he so hungry? He stood up, stretching his shoulders and legs, then waltzed over to the kitchen. Despite all of the nap grogginess, John was feeling good, better than good. He felt like after he got a sandwich or two in him, he'd be ready to take on the whole world. No time like the present, he murmured to himself, opening the fridge and leaning down to grab the mayo, ham, cheese. John debated the merits of the whole dill pickle jar. It would make the sandwich unwieldy, but it gave a good crunch. Maybe he could find a compromise with some potato chips. He stood from the fridge, his arms filled with fixings. What are you cooking? John squeaked a near-voiceless yelp. as Vriska suddenly appeared, leaning her arms on the fridge door. She was wearing one of his shirts, Nick Cage in glorious color on the front.
I didn't see you there. Nice prank.
He spoke weakly, trying to recover. How was she so sneaky?
What are you doing with my shirt?
The question blurted from his mouth, his eyes locked on how big it looked on her small frame. She looked like her bones were sticking out. Maybe he should make her a sandwich, too.
Needed to borrow something.
Your dad and Dave are still cleaning the hunter's apartment, and I've been wearing the same shirt for a while. She watched as he backed away from the fridge, turning to dump his prizes out on the counter next to the bread.
If one of those isn't for me, I'm raiding a fridge, she declared, before hopping up on the counter.
In doing so, John got a glimpse of his cargo shorts loose on her hips. What was more than a glimpse was the rainbow of fading bruises, painting her left leg from the knee down. About halfway down, two spots contained a neat row of stitches.
Whoa, wicked bruises. Can you not sit at the counter while I'm making us food? I don't want to be responsible for getting mayo in an open wound or something.
Don't be lame, she snorted in derision, then scooted down the counter away from his pile of sandwich components.
And don't put cheese on mine. Now is being lame. The cheese is a key component to my masterpiece here.
He turned away from the counter, smiling to himself as he rummaged in the utensil drawer for one of Nana's old silver butter knives. They were perfect for spreading condiments, and they had this really cool pattern on them. He picked one up, feeling the intricate design the handle was forged into, then turned back to the counter. Vriska was wiping her face with the bottom of his shirt, exposing her midriff. The sight stopped him in his tracks for a moment as he watched the skin move over her ribs, her hollow stomach haunting.
How about I make you two sandwiches? No cheese.
He grabbed the bread loaf, undoing the twist tie and taking out 8 slices of bread. Opening the mayonnaise, he stuck the knife in, scooping out a glop and spreading another first slice. She pulled the shirt back down where it belonged, then smiled, nodding.
Sounds great. Are you using a ritual knife to spread mayo?
She narrowed her eyes, squinting at the knife.
No, it's a butter knife. A really old one, a family heirloom, I guess, but I seriously doubt it's sharp enough for anything magical.
He held up the blade, waving it at her. The soft curve of the knife was obvious, the blade a bit wider near the tip than the handle. Perfect for spreading condiments.
Maybe not, but there's something weird about the handle. Gimme.
She leaned towards him, making a grabbing motion with her hand. He pulled the knife back.
No way, this is silver. Doesn't that hurt vampires?
She rolled her eyes at that, but put her hands down.
You're thinking of werewolves, and that's not even true, she sighed, then continued waving her hand as she spoke. But I'm more hungry than I am nosy, so it doesn't matter.
You can let me look at it after I've eaten.
Right, just let me get these fixed up. Do you want chips in yours, pickles?
As he spoke, he moved back to the fridge, retrieving the pickle jar. Maybe he could slice them into sandwich thickness pieces?
Both, definitely both.
As he set to work, assembling her sandwiches, he felt her eyes on the back of his neck. He focused on slicing the pickles, laying the ham, and getting a good layer of chips arranged. As soon as the first was complete, she snatched it out from under him and tore into it ravenously. His own stomach growled in response, so he quickly finished hers and put his own together, cheese included.
Seriously, now.
She spoke around a mouthful of food, barely pausing to swallow before continuing.
Is it so hard to believe you might have magical heirlooms lying around?
She paused, gesturing at him with the remains of her second sandwich.
You've got power, and it's got to come from somewhere.
He shook his head in disbelief.
Not my Nana. She was a normal old lady. I think I would have noticed if she was lighting fires with her mind or something.
Are you lighting fires with your mind?
Not exactly, but I bet that's next. Superman shoots lasers from his eyes. Why is setting fires with my brain so crazy?
Satisfied both with his argument and his sandwiches, he stacked the two together and bit into them both at once. God damn, did that taste good. He quickly bit into it again and again, finishing his double-decker deliciousness in 10 seconds flat.
I'm pretty sure Superman is fictional and also an alien, which is extremely fake.
John wasn't looking at her, too busy pulling the bag of chips closer and shoveling a handful into his mouth. He was still famished. As he chewed, he heard Vriska hop off the counter, then step closer. With one hand, she snatched the butter knife from where it lay abandoned next to the empty bag of deli meat. With the other, she grabbed a handful of chips herself.
Okay, well, it's not like I have any better ideas. Besides, that identification spell, Rose's mom...
Vriska startled him into surprised silence as she let out a hiss, cutting him off.
She isn't exactly a trustworthy source, now is she? Your loud-ass friends acted like the wizard was a pathological liar. That spell of hers put holes in Kanaya.
John turned to her. Putting up his hands in a placating gesture, she was seething, teeth grit and nostrils flared as she breathed heavily.
Well, calm down. I don't trust her either, not entirely. He paused, remembering how skittish the doctor had acted after performing the spell. She was definitely hiding something, is what I was going to say. My results called me a flaming ember or something. I think she knew what it meant, but she was in a hurry to get rid of us. All the more reason not to trust it. We should go back. Get Kanaya out.
She turned away, as though planning to storm off right that instant, Nana's knife as her woefully inadequate weapon. He quickly leaned forward, grabbing her wrist before she could take a step.
No, wait, Kanaya's fine. She told you to come with me and rest. I can text her right now and prove it.
As she turned to glare at him, he quickly fished out his PDA with his other hand.
Seriously, before you go all diehard, let me check on her for you.
I have her number, but fine, go ahead, text her. She's so fussy, she might sugarcoat it if I ask, just to keep me from worrying. She tucked on her wrist, a movement that reminded John he was still holding her.
Whoops, sorry.
He let go, and she shoved the knife into his empty palm. He absently put it down on the counter, focusing his attention on pulling up Kanaya's contact info. The photo he'd taken a few days ago, a candid shot of Kanaya and Rose leaning close as they shared a crepe, now twisted into something much more sad. Vriska had scooted closer, peering at the screen as he opened his texts and began to type.
May 7th, 3:07 p.m. You.
Hey Kanaya, it's John. I just wanted to check up on you, see how you were doing. Are you feeling all right? Is Rose's mom being weird? Is Dave's bro being weird? I'm being weird right now, aren't I? Anyway, just let me know if you need anything.
Kanaya.
Hello, John. I'm quite well. As it turns out, I've reached my maximum capacity for measuring weirdness. Thus, I can no longer say if you are being weird. I can assure you that I have not been made uncomfortable by the actions of either Mr. Strider or Dr. Lalande. As you recall, my mom and my friend Carcat are here with me. Though Carcat had to attend to other matters, he made his stance quite clear before his departure.
You.
Oh, good. That's a relief. Wait, Carcat? Is that the name of that really shooty rock guy? Is that guy a teenager? My dad called him Mr. Gray, but he seemed kind of young.
Kanaya.
Yes, that is him. However, I would advise against referring to him as a rock guy. I would hate to see an altercation break out at Equius's party. He is a bridge troll. In his culture, Carcat has already reached adulthood. His position of authority is both reasonable and earned.
You.
Okay, I got it. Carcat turned his shouty councilman powers at the adults and made sure you would be fine. I will not do any stone-themed pranks to him at the party, by the way.
Kanaya.
I did not realize pranks would be a concern.
You.
Well, yeah, it is a party. When else could I get a chance to test my pranks on a new audience? With my new superpowers, my pranking abilities have gone off the charts.
Kanaya.
Are you about to solicit my assistance on a superpower-themed prank, John?
You.
If I said I was, would you want to do one?
Kanaya.
At the moment, I am not sure if I will be permitted to attend the festivities, quite frankly. I will have to get back to you. For now, I must focus on control. Tell Vriska not to worry, and remind her that she has my number, if you please.
You.
You caught me, haha. I really was wanting to check on you, though. It was not just Vriska who cared. And I really am serious about us doing a prank together, if you are able to. I think it might be good for you to do something fun with your new powers.
Kanaya.
I know, John. Both that you care and that you are sincere, and I appreciate it. I will consider the prank proposition. For now, I must go.
You.
Oh, okay. I will talk to you later, I guess.
Kanaya.
Yes. Talk to you later.
John put down the PDA, looking at Vriska. She had watched in silence as he conducted the conversation. Okay, fine. I won't try to steal your dad's car or anything. She crossed her arms, scowling. It didn't really look like she was scowling at him, though. More like she was scowling at the world in general.
Cool.
He shoved the PDA back where it belonged. Vriska suddenly turned, walking out of the kitchen and into the living room instead. Over her shoulder, she called out,
How did you get invited to Equius's party, anyway?
She sat down on the armrest of the couch, legs dangling over the side.
I don't think I actually knew it was Equius's party. The only time I've ever met the guy, Dad almost hit him with her car.
He began cleaning up the sandwich mess, putting the food stuff back where it belonged, and throwing out the empty package of ham. As he stood at the sink, washing Nana's butter knife, he continued.
Actually, Dave got us an invite from his ghost friend, Aradia. We went to her house to,
He stopped, shifting uncomfortably. Unsure what to say, he focused on carefully drying the knife, making sure no water was trapped in the patterned handle. Silver tarnished, after all. To do what exactly? Something illegal? Salix has all sorts of shady connections. When John turned away from the sink, he saw her gazing at him intently. He suddenly felt a prickle in his mind, a probing question. She's the one who Dave gave the book he used to translate the artifact, he spoke hastily. You don't need to dig. Jeez, let a guy answer a question. Sighing, he walked into the living room, knife still in hand. Sorry. To his surprise, her face flushed, taking on that dark, pinky-purple hue. Force of habit. But I'm trying to break. She muttered this last bit, suddenly focused on her hands, idly inspecting her ragged nails as if they were a manicure. Okay, it's no biggie. He sat down on the other end of the couch, angling himself to face towards her. She turned herself around, still sitting on the arm of the couch, but now her feet rested on the cushion as she faced him. Why is your blood purple? He couldn't help the question. You have scabs on your leg that are blue and silver, but when the doctor took your blood, it was purple. Am I the first vampire you've ever met, John? She asked. He smiled at her sheepishly. Yeah, kinda. I didn't really see any in Denver, not my age anyway. Definitely didn't get a chance to hang out with one. He paused, a new thought blossoming in his mind. You are actually a teenager, right? You're not secretly 1,000 years old or something? Dave had recommended him more than one anime with a premise in that vein. She actually laughed, shaking her head for a moment. No, I'm the real deal. An honest-to-God teenage vampire. I'm She stopped, mid-sentence, face twitching. 17. She stared down at her hands. John watched them involuntarily flex and twitch. She reached up to the melty scar on the side of her head. I'm fucking 17. The levity had disappeared from her voice, a dark tone distant and empty overtaking it. Oh, Chip. John winced at herself. Of course, age would be a horrible topic. She was a girl, and on top of that, she'd been missing for 3 years. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to bring anything up. Friska stuck a hand out to stop him from continuing, making a pained expression. No, it's fine. She took a breath. I just need to stop drifting. I just need to catch myself up. Well, if you're getting caught up, you're due a couple birthdays then, right? He asked. She wasn't looking at him, staring off into the middle distance with a vacant look in her eye. He'd really messed that up. Great going, egg derp. Briska, hey. He shifted in his seat to make the couch jostle a little. What's your favorite flavor of cake? He asked, with as much dad-like cheer as he could muster, reaching out and poking her shoulder as he spoke. Her vision flickered back into focus as she looked first at his finger, then at his face. Your friend Dave brought me a slice of chocolate cake on Saturday. It was pretty good. My dad made that. I'm glad you got a slice, but is that your favorite? It's my only experience with cake, so I guess. He gasped in surprise. No way. Yes way, she said, frowning. No freaking way. Yes freaking way. She was starting to look angry. Why are you acting so weirdly happy about this? He grinned at her, an absolutely genius idea forming in his mind. Because that just means we have to make a bunch of small batch cupcakes so you can figure out your favorites. Then we can bring your favorite cakes to the party. He stood up eagerly. One for each birthday, he pledged. Friska had been eyeing him suspiciously through the whole pitch, but her mouth suddenly twitched in a smile. She stood as well. All right, that sounds extremely dorky. I'm game. Fuck yes! John pumped his fist and gave a hop skip of a dance towards the kitchen in celebration. She laughed at his antics, and the sound felt like a win. No more moping. Not if he could help it. Salix. Much more quickly than the demon had hoped. He was back in the midnight market, early this time. It opened at 6 in the evening, but only the old people came before sunset. With a grimace, Salix realized he was old people. With a doubled grimace, Salix realized he wouldn't be able to languish in the relative peaceability of the PG section of the market. No, he was here for his vampire friends, and that meant braving the skin trade. Sure, the hospitals and blood drives were putting out more of the red stuff than anywhere else in the country, thanks to the better alternative relations within Houston, but according to Carcat, Riska had run their personal support network dry. And with no other options, the easiest place to get a re-up of blood was here. Salix stared grimly at the lines of stalls, which always seemed awash in a sourceless red light, or maybe that was just his skewed perception. He had one and only one contact that made her living in the skins, and that was Holga. She ran a tight ship, clean meat, clean blood, donations sourced. The hag could slap a damned USDA-certified sticker on her cuts if she wanted to. The begrudging respect lingered in his mind as he blocked out the rat of the market, the shadowy people and leering vendors just walking up to her ice boxes and fridges with as much efficiency as he could muster. His rolling cooler rumbled along the floor behind him as he pulled it. Holga was a night hag, so proclaimed her corpse-blue skin and blood-red sclera, no different in abilities from any other hag, but their qualitatively scary appearance gave them a bad rap. Not that Holga minded being a little scary when it was profitable. She was counting a healthy wad of cash from a sale she'd just made, the pale-fanged customer walking away with a weighty red igloo cooler, its contents obvious.
"Sunlight," Holga said flatly as he approached.
"Told you not to call me that, Holga,"
Salix said.
"Just a translation,"
she hummed. But the ghost of a smile was on her generally expressionless features.
"What can I do you for, blood?"
"How do give?"
Salix asked, fishing out his wallet.
2 gallons.
30.50.
Salix blinked.
"Sorry, what?"
he asked.
3,050 United States dollars, she said,
not a hint of mirth.
"I didn't realize you were selling printer ink. Come on, that's triple what you charged me last Christmas. And you were even holiday gouging then,"
Salix said. Helga shrugged, opening a fridge and stacking blood bags in her hand.
"Supply and demand. Lots of new fangs in town. I know you got the money."
Salix frowned to himself, but started counting out the cash. It wasn't like he'd have the stomach to go to some other seller regardless, but the markup still stung. How many new vamps would have had to roll into town to shoot the price up this high?
"Hey, friend. Need a spot there?"
A warm voice came up from behind him. Salix turned to look at the source, and it sidled up next to him in front of the next stall over. He took his measure in a glance. Tall guy, handsome, broody-looking. Hair fell across his face in a nose so rebellious, shaggy black swoop. A leather jacket and distressed jeans covered a lanky frame, and the look was completed with the most subtle touch of eyeliner, highlighting his piercing blue eyes. A vampire playing up his tropes. Salix resisted a chuckle.
"No thanks, I got it," he said,
trying to keep from sounding purely derisive. The vampire put his hands up.
"Just try to help when I can, you know. All too old," he said, offering a sly smile.
"Blood's not going to get any cheaper, that's for sure."
"Uh-huh."
Salix tried to move it along, but Holga was certainly taking her time packing his blood. The vampire laughed a husky, endearing chuckle. "I'm sorry, where are my manners? My name is Ramos." He offered Salix a hand. Salix gave it a side eye, then sighed.
"Salix."
He shook the hand. It was calloused in all the right places. Something about it made Salix's hackles raise. He knew a thing or two about playing an alluring persona, and this man was screaming, scripted.
"Salix, pleasure.
Come here often?"
"More often than I'd like,"
Salix admitted tiredly.
"I know that.
I wish there was some other place for us, but no, stuck in back alleys and warehouses." He breathed a melancholy sigh that oozed you-can-fix-me energy. "You ever just think about how much we've given up to the humans? Stuff that was, by all rights, ours. And we just let them take it."
"No,"
Salix said.
"Holga, come on, I don't have till rapture." "Stuff it, sunlight," she said,
squinting at the expiration date of a bag. Holga ran a tight ship, but that often meant a slow ship. The pretty boy Ramos frowned and stared at Salix. Salix rolled his eyes.
"Look, Ramos, I'm sure you're a beautiful, tortured soul or whatever, but I got about double the tortured vampires in my life than I had yesterday, and I think..."
Alarm bells rang in Salix's head, literally. Disruptive chimes of mental wards he'd set up who knew how long ago. Only an idiot would try to mind-read a demon after all. Ramos staggered back, grabbing his head.
"Fuck, what the fuck?"
he shouted, blood running from his nose.
"You piece of shit! Did you just try to bust into my head?"
Salix stalked forward. He let his demon through, horns splitting his scalp, his eyes washing out in solid colors, the smell of sulfur billowing out from him. Ramos staggered back, a hand out in placation.
"Sorry, I'm sorry."
He coughed, a splatter of maroon staining the back of his hand.
"I just wanted to know if you were a vampire, if you wanted to hear what I had to say.
I'd never cross a demon if I knew about him."
"Try asking next time, you sniveling scumbag,"
Salix snarled. He wasn't about to lunge on a vampire in the midnight market. That was a recipe for disaster, but he didn't want this creep thinking he wouldn't. He turned and grabbed his cooler. Holger, having finally finished packing it, he slapped the cash down to the counter. Thanks. As Salix turned and strode as implacably as he could through the aisles, Ramos made one last move. He stuck out a hand, holding a pamphlet. The bold, blocky title read, Human Isn't Default. With a snap, Salix turned it to ash and walked off. He'd need to warn Eridan about these kinds of freaks.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.